right about now. Hey, everybody. In a society captivated by dark intricacies of true crime, we find ourselves glued to our screens, dissecting each plot point and devouring the suspense. It's all as if we're turned into, you know, amateur detectives, piecing together clues and predicting outcomes as these harrowing real-life stories unfold before our eyes. Ladies and gentlemen, brace yourself for an electrifying episode of A Funny Way of Looking with our guest, Robert Riggs, a titan in investigative journalism. Robert has bagged both the Peabody and Alfred I. DuPont Awards. Just think, you know, Oscars and Pulitzer of broadcast journalism. He's an intrepid reporter who has embedded with the army in Iraq, exposed corrupt politicians, and driven seismic changes in public policy. Currently, the mastermind behind the riveting True Crime Reporter podcast, Robert has also been a go-to expert for media giants like ABC Nightline and CBS 60 Minutes. As we dive deep into the complex world of crime, justice, and societal dilemmas, prepare for a roller coaster ride that will both fascinate and terrify you. So, here we go. Robert, I am so glad to have you on the show today.
I'm humbled by that introduction.
You know, it's all true. So
is it all me?
Right, is it? We're going to start out the good way. Who do you want to do a shout out to?
You know, I want to shout out to the men and women from law enforcement that are in my television documentary called Freed to Kill, about serial killer Kenneth McDuff, one of the most notorious serial killers in the U.S. that you've probably never heard of.
I have not, but I'm sure I will now.
And if they had not really gone all in, there would have been so many more women murdered. We'll never know how many women he abducted and murdered. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, for their hard work, tenaciousness, and not giving up, they got him off the streets eventually. And then I had a whole expose going on about how he got out of prison. A serial killer got out of prison under a cloud of corruption.
Wow.
But my shout outs to law, you know, the dedicated detectives, Texas Rangers, U.S. Marshals, that, you know, and investigators and other agencies, ATF, that they don't make a lot of money, but they're, what I've seen is they're professional, hardworking, and unfortunately, they're not getting a lot of respect these days.
I think that that is a fabulous shout out, and like maybe we need more of those. So I'm gonna we'll post that. You know what? I may just copy that shout out and post it into the comments after the show. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, I want to hit true crime today, and I want to do it from a slightly different perspective than a lot of people probably do true crime. I want to hear about the serial killers and the bank heists and all that. But today we're going to talk about the audience, and we're going to talk about the people who are really into true crime also. So let me just set it up and ask you this question. Walk us through why people seem like, why are they like irresistibly drawn to true crime?
I think it's probably a little bit of what draws me. I have interviewed every type of conceivable criminal, from serial killers, mass killers, serial child molesters, bank robbers, you name it. And, you know, I'm drawn kind of to it, like, what makes them tick? You kind of never really get there, but what makes them tick? You know, is it nurture or nature? I know in my audience, and my audience is about 70% female, 25 to 54. I know the ladies that listen, mm-hmm. Have the same interest, but in a sense of, well, do I know someone like this? You know, do I have a significant other that might be like this? And they also are interested about, if I had been a victim, could I have survived? Could I have gotten away? And then I think we always try to offer some of these up of, you know, tips for prevention, how to protect yourself. The men, 30% of my audience is men, and what they like about true crime are the procedurals. They want to hear that the bad guy the bad lady, got caught, and how? Mm-hmm. How did the detectives do this? And that's the part that really fascinates me, is the how, the work that went into it. And unless you've ever been a member of a jury at a major criminal, like a capital murder trial, it's only then you really learn how much effort goes into an investigation and then the prosecution.
Yeah. I don't understand it. Every time I turn on something like a Dateline or your podcast and start talking about true crime, I'm like sucked in. And I just wonder, like, before they give us the next punchline, can I figure out who it is? Do you think there's like something, I don't know, psychological built in it? Like, I'm surprised really that it's mostly women that watch and listen to your podcast. Well, yeah, Why is that?
I do think it's something psychological in us that's been in us about survival. I've done some research, and I've been trying to gather information and stuff about why, to write an article about it, maybe do a podcast episode about it. But I've looked back at Victorian London, and in those days you had something called the penny dreadfuls. They sold for a penny, and they were these sort of scandal sheets that gave the latest on the, you know, crime, mm-hmm. big crimes and stuff. But the thing that shocked me, they'd have 30,000 people show up to witness a public hanging.
Right there. It's like, there's nothing better to do on a Friday night. Let's go watch the hanging.
Yeah. So this has been with us, you know, and of course, murder in our society and culture goes back thousands and thousands of years. You know, there was a kind of a mummified, he was called the Iceman. I believe he was found buried in the Swiss Ice, 10,000 years old. And I've been doing some research on it, and they found he'd been murdered. He'd been shot in the back with an arrow. So, this is what happens today is nothing new.
Oh my gosh. I gotta ask you about, like, you report on all these crimes, right? And so you write the stories, you interview the victims as well as the actual criminals, and you interview like the police and all this kind of stuff. Is there ever like any kind of, when you're telling the stories, is there ever kind of like any ethical line that you have to stay behind when you're telling the stories, so that it doesn't become like exploitive? Or like, how do you judge that? How do you work that into your podcast?
I think you have to be very careful. And this is a complaint I've got about many, many true crime podcasts. I want to tell the host, you know, someone died here. Mm-hmm. A family lost a family member. This affects them for the rest of their lives. So that's where you want to walk a fine line, that you're not offending the victim's families, or if it's a victim of rape or something, and you know, you got to be careful. So I try to be professional and factual, not sensational, not giggly. There's a lot of them that giggle, and they have stuff like that. No, just the facts, ma'am.
You know, what do you think about these? And this is not true. Well, it might be true crime. You got incidents that are happening, instead of people helping, they're actually got their cell phones out filming for, you know, the next YouTube post that they're going to make, or TikTok. What do you think about that? Kind of weird.
You know, that just seems to be pervasive in our society, that everybody with a phone is a voyeur now.
Yeah. And,
you know, perhaps they need to help, render aid, put on a tourniquet or whatever, but they're busy getting that moment.
Yeah.
And, if you go to various tourist spots, it's like everybody is experiencing it through the phone, you know, it's like, okay. It bothers me. It was like, hey, you know,
why? Yeah, I wanted to hit that.
It's like people think, well, I've got to have my moment. This is going to be a great social media moment. Might get me more followers, you know? So,
yeah. How do you approach like sensitivity? And we're going back to like, you know, the rape victim or the family and all that kind of stuff. How do you approach that?
Well, I really try to be very professional and factual and not embellish with adjectives and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I've had episodes with crime victims on, families, mothers of crime victims. And, you know, you want to be sort of soft-spoken with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got an episode that's very, very popular, and it's by the little girl. She was then a little girl who grew up next door to Ted Kaczynski, the bomber, the Unabomber. Yeah. Fascinating story. Fascinating story.
Wow.
So, you know, I can see people could come on and really sensationalize it, but that's, you know, I'm an old school reporter. I just don't believe in doing that. Let me just tell you the story as we know it.
Have there ever been stories that you've decided not to do because of like any of the ethical concerns, or it might like hurt the people or anything like that?
Oh yeah. In your career, there's always stuff like that. Now I will tell you, as one of the things that bothered me back in reporting is that in television, there'd be some incident, shootings, what have you. And they would send, reporters to the homes. I would never do this, to knock on the door of the victim's family to try to get a comment.
Right.
You know, well, how did it feel? And this sort of stuff. Well, here's what I know from doing these. The victim's families are in shock. They're really not of presence of mind really to talk. And I just don't think it's ethical to go to them then. If it's going to be a serious story later, the public can learn from, you know, go sit down with them later. But it should be what is the public going to learn from this? Well, if it's just that they're sobbing and weeping and they're sad, well, we all know that, so that's, you got to be careful about not crossing that line. And that was something I abhorred in the industry, and I would not do it.
Who was it? Was it Robert Palmer that had that song about, you know, go out and get the next line, is the head dead yet? And go dirty laundry. That was the name of the song.
Yeah, that is with the Eagles drummer singer, not Glenn Frey. God, I'm going blank.
Yeah, I can't remember.
He lives here in Dallas.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, Dirty Laundry. Yeah.
Dirty Laundry. That's the song.
I think that stemmed from, maybe his name will come from me. He was in a lawsuit, and I think his wife was suffering. What was she suffering from? Lupus, something, you know, something debilitating. And they called her to testify and just to really just make a
Don Henley.
Don Henley to make an there issue of it.
Yeah. Don Henley.
Court and the Eagles, among my favorite bands, Don Henley and Glenn Frey. When Glenn Frey passed away, I was like, ooh, this is getting close to home. One side story, there's a Tex-Mex place here in Dallas called Mia's, and it used to be just a hole in the wall. And I love going in there. I love the food. And I remember walking in there one day, and there was Don Henley and Glenn Frey sitting with caps pulled by down, kind of, you know, incognito, but talking. And I thought, I wonder if they're writing a song or they're talking about the next thing. And nobody bothered them and stuff. And they were, interestingly, they were sitting at the same table where Jerry Jones reputedly inked the deal to buy the Cowboys.
There you go.
Yeah. Now Mia's has moved on to a bigger location. They were so popular, but I loved it. Was that little tiny place and old school, but you never knew who you'd see in there. You might see Robert Riggs.
Oh man. So let's keep talking about this, the cell phone and being able to just, and not engaging, but just taking pictures. Like how has, like, do you think technology has changed the way that, the whole, you know, empathy for people, the ethics for people and everything has changed? Like how has technology changed, you know, just crime in general, true crime?
Well, in terms of social media, there's been plenty written about this, but you know, you have trolls and what have you, and the toxicity of the nasty things, you know, people can be anonymous. My wife is fond of saying that she was in the entertainment business on stage at one point in her career. And I've asked her, like, were these feelings and emotions, were they really always in people? And she said, yeah, I think many, many people always wanted to be the star in their own movie, but there was no way they were ever going to get cast because they didn't have talent. Mm-hmm. Well, now anybody with a cell phone has access to do whatever of look at me, look at me, look at me.
Yeah.
And frankly, she's a person who was on stage. She hates having her picture taken, doesn't want anything. And even though I was a guy on television, I'm not all that. I'm still kind of an introvert, you know, if you know what I'm saying, you know.
No, I'm a total introvert. I totally get that. Believe me.
Yeah. You know, that probably sounds weird, but I'm not one to really go, hey, look what we're doing. So yeah.
I am. I'm fascinated about true crime and the availability of information around the world. And I just wonder, now you've been doing this for decades, can people literally like get on the internet, do some research, watch the TV shows, listen to the podcast, interview people, and then ever come up with like the perfect crime? Do you think is it possible? Or is there too much technology on the other side that says, nope, gotcha before you even got out the door?
Well, even when there wasn't the technology, you know, it never goes according to plan. There's always something hiccup, something like that, something. You know, so I've really never seen that perfect crime in all the stuff I covered. And one of the things I've seen in crimes is that people commit crimes or a murder of a spouse or something, and they stage it, but they stage it the way they've seen it on television, and it doesn't happen that was that it. Way. And okay. it gives itself away, you know.
Why? I mean, you see the Hollywood directors and the writers, and they've all got their scripts. We've all seen Ocean's 11, you know, bank robberies and stuff like this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why is it that people can't get away? Is it because it's too romanticized? It's because it's their first one and they get messed up? Like, why?
You know, we're
so hard.
We're all human. We're not perfect.
Yeah.
And then there's the other thing of they'll tell somebody. And there's never a secret.
Loose lips.
In the criminal world, you know, somebody will always flip on somebody. And I'll give you an example. I did a series years ago with cooperation from the FBI when identity theft was just starting. This was a landmark series. And there was a guy traveling around the country. And he really had this perfect scheme for doing counterfeit fraudulent checks, coming in, hitting banks and stuff for 300 grand, and they would be gone. And when I looked over it, I was thinking, wow, this guy was doing the perfect crime. But he got involved in something, told another guy about it. That guy got busted by the FBI on another charge, unrelated. And he says to them, let's make a deal. I can tell you about a huge case. And the FBI had to solve this case. And it was going on all over the country. It was huge. And so there was the mistake. You know, I remember discussing with my father-in-law. I thought, you know, maybe if you would just do one or two of these and stop, you might get away with it. But they don't.
Yeah, people just have to talk. I guess that's the whole problem right there.
Yeah, well, and I have to say, as a reporter, on those kind of financial crimes, you're learning all the details and you're thinking, I wonder if I might.
Well, I've wondered that, you know, it's like, it's almost like you're getting a PhD in true crime. You're seeing where all the mistakes are. It sounds like people talking too much is the biggest mistake.
Oh, I see that happen in everything. You know, I mentioned the television show with Kenneth McDuff. I found out that as publicity was everywhere about the abduction of Colleen Reed from a car wash at Christmas in Austin, Texas, she was just a young accountant, that McDuff's told associates and stuff about it and everything else. And there were in criminal circles, there was talk about it. Mm-hmm. And then when Later, when one of them, they were already on his trail, but then later when one of them got in trouble, was getting busted, you know, she suddenly ups that, well, by the way, you know, that girl that disappeared in Austin, that was Kenneth McDuff. So it's, I don't know. There's some, I guess there's something human about, we just can't keep a secret. Now in McDuff's case, he was what the FBI categorized as a sadistic sexual serial killer, which meant his real pleasure wasn't the sexual assault. It was the torture and the suffering of the victim. Mm. And he usually had an accomplice. And the accomplice was ne'er-do-well, not strong personality, a follower. And he picked him that way because he could control him. But he needed this is crazy. He needed an audience. Murder was like performance art for him.
I'm shocked. Is there like a, what do you want to call this, profile of a serial killer? Because I remember you and I talking before, you said they look kind of normal.
That's the one common thing I've always seen. They look very normal, don't stand out, just like, you know, like McDuff. I've got pictures of him in civilian clothes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just looks like a big goofus. When you see him in his mugshots and other things, and you know what he did, then it's like, ooh, this is the boogeyman. But what I try to emphasize to people, particularly women, because they're the target of these guys, is that they're not going to look like the boogeyman. Same on child predators as well. You know, they used to teach stranger danger, and that which was just all wrong.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's going to be the scout leader. It might be the minister, people that parents trust, and they're very normal. So that's, you know, that's the one thing. Nobody shows up with horns like the devil. Now, you know, I just did a thing about there's been a deadly war going on between the outlaw motorcycle gangs around the Southwest. And if you see those guys out there, you know, they look worse than Sons of Anarchy. They're all kind of, threatening looking. You know,
have you actually interviewed those guys like in person or?
I've during my career. Yes, I have. Yeah. I interviewed mobsters when I was in New York. So. Yeah.
Now, when you are interviewing the mobsters, you're interviewing the gangs and all this. I mean, are you like afraid, or are they just like, hey, let's have a coffee and we'll talk? But you know, how is it? I don't get it.
I guess in my case, you've done it so much, you're not affected, and it was kind of my personality. But no, I know one thing: you don't show fear. You want to have a strong presence and let them know, you know, that you're here, you mean business. But I was always respectful, and I was always very, and it's still to this day, I'm very successful in interviews with inmates and ex-cons, because I don't go off on some preaching of judgment and everything. I just talk to them about their background and stuff like that, because what I'm really trying to bring out them and why, and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Have you ever talked to like somebody and you're interviewing them and you all of a sudden you go, this is the guy, this is the criminal, but I don't know if you say it to them, or how do you handle that when you've discovered?
Everyone that I was ever interviewing, they'd been caught.
Okay.
Yeah. They'd all been caught. I remember being in a prison in West Texas. And I was doing a series about child predators, serial predators. And I'd heard about this guy, older guy. And I got an interview with him. And I'm interviewing him. I got my camera crew there. And I'm interviewing him. He's sitting on his bunk. And this is going to sound odd to the listeners, but this is kind of how things come out. It's a technique that was used, I also know, was used by the profilers, the original ones at the FBI, you know, sort of sympathetic, you know, and I'd listen and stuff, and, you know, and it they'd open up. They'd feel like, oh, Robert, you're my friend. You understand. Well, near the end of the conversation, I mean, I'm talking about, well, you know, how do you pick the right child? Stuff like that. Uh-huh. And I do open-ended questions as well, because you never know what you're going to get. I don't ask questions that are going to be a yes or no answer. And he gets off his bunk, and he's got this kind of hiding place, and he pulls out like it's thick. It's 2 inches thick. And it's a manual on how to lure children.
This is something he's written in prison.
Oh yeah. He's written it in prison. And he had told me, and what kind of led to it, he kept telling me, well, you know, they have a look. They have this look of hunger in their eyes. And I was like, I've never seen that. What is that? And I kept, let me show you. And kind of, he just got into it. He pulls out this manual, and he had clipped ads from magazines for products, all stuff with children, of examples of, yeah, that's the look, that's the kid I'm after. And he had long descriptions of how to operate. And even during the interview, described them. And now I have to tell you, as a reporter, I'm sitting there like, holy cow, you know, it's, you know, like you're looking at the career, like you are rolling on this, aren't you? And by the end of the interview, he gave me his manual. You know, I said, well, you know, it sure would help me in just doing this. He gave me the manual, and I immediately gave the manual to the profiler at the FBI in Quantico that worked the child cases. And they used it in the interview, a raw interview for teaching agents, because it was something they'd never seen.
Already sitting here with my head blown.
Yeah. Now I have to tell you, you got to put on your game face, because particularly children, it's the most disgusting, disturbing, make you sick, make you want to wring them by the neck while you're sitting there. But you know that I'm not going to get anything that can kind of tell people until I, you know, play the game.
He was already caught, and I don't know if this is true or not, but was he separated from general population?
Because he was a serial offender. He had been in and out. So, yeah.
Was he separated from everybody else? Hearing is that child molesters don't make it long in prison.
That's kind of become a myth. The thing is, the prison system has really become pretty hardcore. And also a lot of people don't talk about what they do. Now, I do know cases, and I know of a particular case where they found out a guy had raped and murdered a little Hispanic girl, and the Hispanic gangs in the prison mm-hmm. heard about it. And the guy was was eating in the chow hall, and a gang member walked by him and in a split second cut his throat, and he was dead right there. And it was like, you offended our race, that sort of thing. But otherwise, you know, not a lot. Some of them, they try to put on other units, segregated, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who's the scariest guy that you ever, or woman, that you ever interviewed?
Somebody that would be scary in public, could be scary in public. Golly, there's so many. Kenneth McDuff, the serial killer, who he hated me, but I wouldn't have worried about him out in public, because he was a guy, he's a big guy, but he's a bully. Mm-hmm. And his preferential victim was a short, petite brunette, you know, 5 foot or less, that he could control. But a guy, you know, a guy he kind of would back off on. Although, you know, I interviewed his cellmate at one point from a maximum security unit, and they talked about he had this explosive temper and might just go off unexpected. It would scare everyone. There's a mass killer I've interviewed who, during the interview, told me he'd like to shoot me. And I mean, the guy was highly, he was an SMU business grad and stuff, highly educated, but he just, problems. And he had ridden around Dallas on his Harley at night, randomly killing truckers and stuff in traffic. Mm-hmm. And it was a fascinating interview, you know, cause I mean, like, why? And he said at the beginning of the interview, what I'm going to say to you is going to make no sense. And there became a moment where he saw the look on my face, like, you gotta be kidding me. And he smiles and laughs and says, I told you it wasn't going to make any sense. But, irrational motivation. So in his case, and I have a podcast from the interview with him. In his case, he said he was extremely angry about the unfairness of life, and he was very upset that John Kennedy, the son of the president, who you know, who crashed in his plane and stuff, that he had all of this notoriety and attention and wealth, and he said, and you know, that just pees me off.
You know,
it just ate him up to see people. He felt, I'm working hard and all, I'm not getting anywhere, and this is unfair. And I looked at him at one point and said, you know, life is not fair. And he gave me this look. And yeah.
Do you have guards in the cells with you while you're interviewing these people?
Sometimes, they're always standing somewhere nearby. Funny you should ask that. So I was doing a series about frivolous lawsuits by inmates, and it was a huge problem. And they were filing these frivolous lawsuits in federal courts. And I found it, by the dozens and dozens, and it was causing a big problem. And I was able to find out from some, they were doing it because that meant they got a bus trip or in a prison bus. Mm-hmm. To federal court. They got out of prison. They just wanted to go out and see stuff. And I had an interview, and I used to like, they don't even really permit it anymore. I used to like to do my interviews one-on-one, not in a, you know, not behind bars. Now they put them in cages. There's a cage, and especially death row. But I preferred, you know, knee to knee, folding chairs to do the interview. And so I'd heard about this inmate and found all, he'd filed all of these lawsuits. My God, it cost the state so much money. And one of his lawsuits, he had sued because his Rice Krispies did not go snap, crackle, pop.
Uh-huh.
I kid you not. Snap, crackle, pop. So I'm like, this is so over the top. And I thought, this is going to be some interview. And so the door opens and, two guards bring in this guy, and he's a giant. Oh my God. He's like 7 feet. And I mean, he's just huge. You know, his arms, his biceps are bigger than my thighs.
Uh-huh.
And, no hand. They've taken his handcuffs off, sitting down in the chair, and they go, "Oh, Robert, he's all yours. We'll be outside." And they slam the door, and I'm like, and the crew's looking at me like, "Are you sure this is a good idea?" Yeah. But again, I was polite and everything else, and inquisitive, and I didn't do confrontational kind of stuff. So he never got mad. He kind of, you know, laughed about it and stuff. So it turned out to be a really good interview.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Do you think any of the serial killers and murderers or heist people that they actually do reform in prison and they're sorry, and if they got back out, they'd be okay or no?
Oh God, no. The career violent felons, and especially the serial killers, don't let them out. I don't see anything in prison systems today that bring about any reform for violent crimes. And I'm kind of like you need to reserve prisons for violent crimes. Now, other kind of offenses, the robberies, the serial thieves and stuff like that. Yeah, I did a podcast episode with a project that in which they teach inmates. Mm-hmm. Now you got to qualify how to come out of prison to be entrepreneurs, and they have to really want it. They've got to apply. They've got to write a long paper about what they want to do, and they've got a great rate for inmates not reoffending and coming back and actually having thriving businesses out here. Okay. But they're not the killers. They're not the, that sort of stuff. And it's a privately funded deal. It's not state money. And they're in some of our prisons, but you really have to jump through hoops as an inmate and show that you want it, Now they've had some failures, guys reoffended, but it's probably one of the most impressive things that I ever saw the prison system. The other thing I'd seen was Chuck Colson, who was in the Watergate thing, who then later he reformed, and he had a prison ministry. I saw that as the way they did it was pretty effective. The important thing is for when they come out, they can't go back to the old neighborhood and the old friends at all, or they'll mm-hmm. be right back in it. So it is, it's tough. That, where do you start? I've got, he was a longtime source, really helped me in investigating the corruption. He was a gang member, and, he knew because he was a ranking member in a gang. He knew everything going on in every prison, and he'd taken a liking to me and, was really a confidential source. And the other interesting thing about him, he was a Mensa. He was a genius. He had taken every college class offered in the Texas system. He'd taken every trade school class. And he recently got out after doing 44 years. Can you imagine?
No. Could you trust him?
He's talked about... he got out and was like, what is a cell phone? What is this? What is this? And so he began writing a book that he smuggled out in pieces about life inside. And it's very well written, but there's certain context and stuff like that. But it's the nitty gritty of what goes on in a prison. And he's so articulate and all. I'm going to work on an audio book with him because, somebody who spent that much time, mm-hmm. Lord, gang members came by, threw a chain around his cell, put a padlock on it, threw Molotov cocktails in, trying to burn him alive. It's a real life story that you don't really ever see or hear about, and he's got it. He lived it. And so I'm breaking down the book, trying to figure out, okay, how do we turn this into a compelling podcast, but it's an audio book. And I think people will be very interested because it is so, so different.
I'm interested right now, and I'm just listening to you talk, and I can't close my mouth. I've been trying. But it just keeps falling back open. So,
well, he had been the reputed, he had a reputation, the reputed hitman for a gang. Feared. If you saw him, you'd like, are you kidding me? Because he was kind of a shorter, wiry guy. But he was brilliant, smart guy. And he would always say to me that, well, I'm out of the gang. I renounced it. And I was like, hey, blood in, blood out, baby. Why? I don't know. Why are you still alive? And he would laugh and all of this. And In the prison system in the main corridors, there's about 3 foot out from each sidewall is a yellow line, and the inmates have to stay within that yellow line. The center is staff and stuff, but inmates do not get outside that line. You know, Johnny Cash talked about walking the line.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it's just like traffic coming in, you know, opposite directions. And this is back in the day where I really had free run of the prisons, and Johnny and I are walking together, going from some other one place to the other. And I start noticing that every inmate coming to us is looking down, or some are even stopping and turning to the wall.
Uh-huh.
And the inmates that we're walking up on are like, they're getting out of the way. No one wants to look at him. And I said, hey, if you're out of the gang, hey, why is everyone turning their heads and eyes down? You know, they don't want to think they've disrespected you. And he just laughed. Oh, you know, they're just polite. And, I said, you know, look, and we even recently had a conversation about his reputation. He was a reputed hitman, never got prosecuted, never caught for any murders in the system, but boy, people think he did them. And I said to him, you know, hey, what about it? I'd ask you about it before. And he always said, well, you know, you can get a paper, you know, an inmate gets a paper cut in the morning in a maximum security unit, and by the end of the day, they say, I've cut off his head. And he laughs about it. So, you know, he talks around it, around it. Yeah. But it's something that the public, boy, will it be an insight? It's just one of those stories you don't get. It's just so rare. And then everybody's going to wonder, what makes this guy tick? He's so smart. And he did 44 years because of stuff he also did after he got in prison. Like, he had 6 prison escapes. I remember I was on a maximum security unit interviewing another inmate. Podcast mm-hmm. is about him. Dennis Hope, the notorious prison escapee. Fascinating story. And I hear my guy Johnny is there. And he is out working in the warden's vegetable in Rose Garden. And I go out to see him, and he's, you know, tilling the soil and everything else. And I look around and I open my jacket and I said, hey, I don't have a recorder running. We've talked about this. The camera crew's inside, no microphone. People say you blew people up in prison with bombs. Now, would you tell me, how does somebody build a bomb in prison?
Uh-huh.
And he got this big smile on his face, and he's holding a hoe in one hand, and he looks down. And when we look down, he's tapping his toe on the 50-pound bag of fertilizer. And he says, hey, I knew about fertilizer bombs long before those boys in Oklahoma City. And I thought, oh my God. So I knew the warden. And so I got to tell the warden. Uh-huh. And he knows I told the warden. I go in and tell the warden. I said, hey, why do you have Johnny out here in your Rosen vegetable garden right out here? He said, because you got to keep your enemies close in this place. I want to know what he's doing. So I told him the story of what had just happened. The warden just dropped his head. It was like, oh my God, you're kidding. I never even thought, you know.
So, wow. I guess you get resourceful.
Yeah. And well, a week later, he walked out the front gate dressed as a guard.
And he got caught again and put back in, I'm guessing.
Of course he got caught again.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I could listen to you tell stories like for the next hours and hours and hours. Mm-hmm. I want to do something.
Well, you'll have to come on the podcast.
And I will have to come on the podcast. I actually want to get you and Doug Knowles together and talk and see what goes on between your two minds. That would be amazing to talk about.
And tell the listeners, you know, Doug Knowles is in California, was a civil lawyer and got the calling to help in prisons. And he came up with this methodology of quieting an angry person in 90 seconds. Couldn't we all use that?
We definitely could use that. Let's find out about more about you. We've talked about the serial killers and the heist and the child abductors and all that kind of stuff. Let's talk about Robert Riggs. We're going to play a game for a second called This or That. I'm going to give you two choices. You can pick one or the other, but not neither or both. And if you have to justify anything, yeah, we could do that maybe too. And you know what? I'm going to start with super, super, super simple and pedestrian. You're only the third person I have ever asked this question to. And the question is, coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Yeah. Morning or night? Do you do it?
Morning. Two okay. cups.
Morning reporting or night reporting?
Reporting?
Yeah.
Night.
Night? Okay. True crime books or true crime documentaries?
You know, I don't do either. It's strange because that's my world. If I'm reading a book, it's history or it's business.
Okay.
Don't it's about things I don't know about.
Gotcha. How about paper notes or digital notes?
I do a combination. I do paper. I've always had the reporter's notebook. But if something is important, I find I need to write it by hand. And there's brain research around this, that if you put it down by hand, it sticks in your brain.
Yeah.
So I will also kind of copy and put things in digital so they're searchable. So I'm a blend of both.
Yeah. I agree with you about the paper thing. It's just like a feel and a something to paper that you don't get with digital.
Yeah.
You know? Solo investigation or team investigation?
Team.
Okay. When you go out, have you ever done the solo, or is you mostly team, all team?
I was always the leader of the team. I had producers and stuff like that. But they were terrific. You know, you just have to work together.
Yeah.
And, I think early in my career, solo, I did solo stuff, but later as you advance in more complex stories, team.
Got it. How about interviewing victims or interviewing law enforcement?
Well, I'd rather interview law enforcement, how they do. And it's solely because the pain in the victims, the pain.
Okay. It goes back to our ethics that we were talking
well,
about.
Well, and that, you know, in my free to kill, I've got the victims in there and the families, and they needed to be there. The public needs to understand what this does to people. But these are tough interviews because you're bringing back these awful events in their life that still affect them.
Yeah.
And there was a moment, Colleen Reed's sister, I took her back to the church where they had the service for her sister. It was murdered by McDuff. And, you know, like I say, I'll ask open-ended questions, things I don't know the answer to. And I said to her, when you're alone at night, what do you and your sister talk about? You know, now her sister's deceased. And boy, did it come out. Because she did have conversations about the sister she missed. And what she described and the anguish, boy, you just... and tears, the viewer really got a feel for what suffering is put on these people by violent criminals. And I thought that I wanted people to understand the consequences, you know. I think it's important in these kind of things that they need to hear it.
Yeah. Interesting. How about old unsolved cases or recent crimes?
Mix of both. It all depends on just how unusual the crime is. I don't do your garden variety stick-ups and stuff like that. There's got to be some twist, something unusual, something that is challenging the detectives and all. So old would have been McDuff, you know. You know, I've got one that I did not long ago about a murder in Austin, a love triangle murder, by involving these terrifically talented cyclists. And it's one of those things like, wow, what happened? Yeah, you had everything going for you. How did it get to this? So, yeah.
Don't you ever get like scared that the some of these things are going to come back to you and people are going to go like, that reporter, I'm going to find him? Or does that ever haunt you?
That happened during my investigation of corruption in the system. When I began exposing that you could buy your way out, well, it ended. And then you had many, many inmates that were upset that I'd blown their chances of getting out. Mm-hmm. So the anger was directed to me. There was a time when the U.S. attorney wanted to put U.S. marshals at my home. I was like, you know, I'd been a staffer on a defense committee in Congress and trained by the Army and every weapon imaginable. I was like, I can take care of myself here. The threats do happen. Mm-hmm. You don't want it affecting, you know, your family and stuff. And I had a case where a public official that eventually went to prison because of my reporting called and threatened my wife, got her on the call, got the phone number. So she just delivered the threat to my wife for me. On the McDuff thing, mm-hmm. all of that went away when he got caught and it came out, and he became the poster boy for change and cracking down on the laws. And he was the most hated man in the prison system. He was on death row. If I had death row inmates tell me, if they open those doors, we're killing that guy. We're going to kill him. Tear him limb from limb. Wow. So I was like, well, thankfully they don't think of Robert in this anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. How about local crimes or international crimes?
God, you know, then it all depends. Mm-hmm. International, there was a point in my career I was doing terrorism, you know, before 9/11, interesting, before 9/11 and then after 9/11. And that was international, was in London, in the UK, and places. And those were fascinating stories, very different. And then local, it just, you know, there are huge corruption cases that are interesting. You know, it's just not violent crime. It's other kinds of crimes.
Yeah. Do you see crimes that are going on and you're like, I wish I could expose this, but you're either too busy or it would take too long. Like, especially I'll even go like, especially in like, say politics, anything like that, where you just wish you could do something more about it.
Well, these days it's just Robert and, you know, some help. I don't have the resources that I had when I was at CBS and places. So, I'm not able to do things. One thing I do, I've got some volunteers that were in law enforcement, one that was a member of an FBI violent crime squad. I'll ask the person, hey, can I give this information to him and let him look around in it for mm-hmm. you? So, you know, you try the best you can to help.
Okay. Gotcha. How about serial killers or heist masterminds?
Serial killers.
Okay.
It's just, you know, so you're just like, wow, nature or nurture?
Gotcha. How about face-to-face interviews with criminals or anonymous tip-offs?
Well, I always prefer face-to-face interviews.
Okay.
Yeah, but anonymous tips can be the bread and butter of an investigative reporter, but you got to go prove it. It can put you on the right track, but you got to go prove it.
Gotcha. Okay. How about maintaining professional detachment or getting emotionally involved?
You try, and typically reporters, there is a detachment. But when you really get involved, like in this McDuff case and others, where you're talking to the victims' families and you're, oh my God, you see the grieving going on. It does get to you. Matter of fact, in that case, it got to the law enforcement officers. But it also fueled them. Like, we gotta solve this.
Yeah.
And there was a U.S. Marshal named Parnell McNamara. And Parnell today is the sheriff in Waco, McLennan County. And he was present for the confession of McDuff's accomplice about the murder of Colleen Reed. And he told me that driving back to Waco, he started crying and thinking of the horror and everything else. And he said to me, you know, suddenly I wasn't the tough old bird and lawman I thought I was. Now, I want to tell you, this is a tough guy. Seen everything, done everything, old West family and law enforcement in Texas for 120 years. And cousin, by the way, of Taylor Sheridan. Mm-hmm. And it got to him. But it also became a driving force for him as well. Yeah. So I'll tell you, one of the things that was hard for me, you know, I did three wars, but I was an embedded reporter in the last one with the lead unit in the invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm. So before the war began, I lived with them. We were there. I was in the tent, ate with them, tent with them. And so you began having a personal, you knew them. You knew everybody as a person. So it wasn't some anonymous body at a crime scene or accident or something like that. You knew them. Some I did stories with, and then they got killed. That kind of got to all of us in the crew, you know, because they're people we knew. They'd, you know, so that was rough. That, you know, I still think about it today.
I totally believe that. Let's, I got a couple more hard ones, and then I want to get to a couple of thought-provoking questions for you. How about legal loopholes that free the guilty or laws that incriminate the innocent?
Well, you know, the Innocence Project has done great work about identifying wrongly convicted people. Now, DNA has really been a big help in all of that, not only clearing the innocent, but also finding the guilty. Legal loopholes, you know, those sort of, I don't know that I've ever really seen that, those in cases, you know. Okay. Look, if you're a good prosecutor, you ought to be able to do this, you know?
Gotcha. Let's go thought-provoking for a second, okay? Knowing who committed a crime but not being able to prove it, or proving a crime but not knowing who did it?
Well, for me, the interest is the crime and not knowing who did it. And okay. So I've been doing a series on cold cases. And, you know, now with the use of forensic genetic genealogy, they're solving 40-year-old cases now.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, it is amazing. It is amazing.
It brings me back to my question earlier about, could someone ever commit the perfect crime, or just you could keep your mouth shut, not tell anybody, look like a normal guy, could you get away with it? And it's like, if you forgot to leave your cell phone home one day, you might just get caught.
Well, and so there are these cases where, you know, people have gotten away with murder and think they've gotten away with it, and now technology has caught up with them. And I've done in the podcast, I got a series about forensic genetic genealogy in cases. One about a serial rapist who, good gosh, he had raped so many women in Texas. And then using DNA, these are old cases, but now they start applying this, and they find out he had victims in Oklahoma and Arkansas. Wow. And they tracked him down. And because they ran it, his DNA that was left at crime scenes, they ran it through these social channels where people, you know, are doing search, and they found family people on the family tree, and then the detectives had new leads,
yeah,
to narrow down, and then so they identified him, and the FBI and the Dallas prosecutor and police worked on this. They put a hidden camera looking at his home because they were doing, well, I call it dumpster diving, but they, in the middle of the night, they were taking things, trash, that where you might leave DNA, cups, what have you. And the camera was there to prove there were no other males going in there. None.
So, you know, we all hear about this DNA and everyone just kind of throws it around. But when you talk about they found DNA, is it like the sci-fi level? It's like we found a crumb with his saliva on it? Or is it like you got to find like a whole head of hair? What is it when you find DNA to prove something? How much do you need? And
well, this is the big revolution in technology. So for years, they've taken the samples, they've got the DNA, and it is set on shelves and stuff. Some never tested. There's a whole government program going on now where they are bringing it out and testing it. Mm-hmm. And one of these victims had heard about this new testing and everything going on. She actually went to the police and got a detective like, hey, have you thought about this? And they went in, they found her evidence stored, refrigerated, still to, you know, this is 30 years later.
Uh-huh.
And so now they use forensic genetic genealogy. And the other thing that's happened with DNA testing, there are some labs that can take a minute sample. You can't even see it by the eye.
Uh-huh.
And develop it. And in this case, they ran it then in the genetic websites and got onto the family tree. Mm-hmm. And then what they go back and they start looking, they're reviewing their cold case files, and they often find these guys' names are in there. They just never had enough to get to them, or they're overdone. Okay. And so this guy, they put him away for the rest of, he's like 70. They put him away for the rest of his life.
Well,
and I have an episode about it. It's a fascinating episode.
Thank you, Ancestry.com. All right, then.
Well, I don't know. Some of them do not participate. I don't think 23andMe will participate with law enforcement. Others do. Some of them have it set that you have to, and they don't really tell you it's there. You have to make a choice to click that law enforcement can have access. But it's, you know, it's the family tree.
Yeah, it's out there, right? So I got a couple more for you. How about revealing a source to solve a case or protecting your source at the cost of justice?
Well, you know, if the source has committed a crime, I'm not protecting them.
Yeah.
There really is no such thing as a confidential source anymore in litigation. If you have a confidential source, the judge is going to ask you, if this story is based on that, let's hear who they are. The other side has a right to take the deposition and cross-examine them. I didn't have confidential sources. I had sources that would provide tips and stuff like that, mm-hmm. to lead me places, but nothing that would ever say because if you get sued, you're going to have to defend every sentence.
Yeah.
Every sentence. And this is why investigative reporting has really gone away in this age that, you know, the newspapers have been financially gutted. Same thing has happened to broadcast news. And what's left, they don't really want to spend the money. And the litigation is very expensive. Very okay. expensive.
Wow. Okay. Last one. Uncover a deeply settling truth that could shake societal faith in the justice system, or withhold the information and maintain public order.
Oh no, I'm bringing it out. The McDuff case was a case of that, where The Texas system had been in trouble with the federal courts for more than 10 years for overcrowding. And the Democrats and the Republicans had run for re-election on law and order, and they were passing tougher laws, longer sentences. The problem is they didn't have any place to put them. And the jails in Texas had backed up. They had serious overcrowding. The sheriffs were mad. And the system was on the verge of getting taken over by a judge. And rather than suffer that political embarrassment controversy, the administration at the time ordered the parole board, who they appointed, let them out. And so one of the things we discovered in the investigation that came out was that they were releasing 140 inmates a day, 7 days a week.
Jesus.
And when one of the parole board members was really being grilled in a hearing that was based on my story, he suddenly lost it and told the truth and said, well, Senator, we're dragging the bottom of the barrel. We're scraping the bottom of the barrel, you know, to make room. Mm-hmm. And boy, that caused an explosion. The legislature didn't even know that was going on. And suddenly it explained there'd been a huge spike in crime around Texas, particularly in Houston was off the charts. Other places, Central Texas, Fort Worth was bad. Uh-huh. And this was why they're letting, you know, the violent of the violent career criminals out. And the first thing they were doing was, you know, like McDuff, the next day after he walked out of prison, he abducted a woman and killed her and continued on a spree for 3 years.
Jeez. All right. We're going to have to do this again. I'd love to be on your podcast one day and just listen to you, to talk to you some more. This is amazing. Either that or we'll just get together for coffee someday.
Coffee sounds great. I'm a coffee. It's got to be early morning.
I'll get up and do early morning instead of my normal get up at 10. So I definitely want people to be able to still check you out and learn more about you. We've got your website at truecrimereporter.com. And of course, you are all over the internet, interwebs on Facebook and Instagram at True Crime Reporter. And you've got a LinkedIn going at Robert Riggs TV. And for everyone who's not actually watching but listening, Riggs is R-I-G-G-S, so Robert Riggs TV on LinkedIn. And you've got some YouTube going on at Robert Riggs True Crime Reporter. So
yeah.
This has been an absolutely fascinating
And Michael, you can find the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We're in Apple, Spotify, everywhere. And if you want to watch, we video, and you can actually watch the interview on YouTube.
That.
And YouTube is opening up Google Music to podcasts, so we'll be there soon too.
Is it really? I did not know that.
I've
got a subscription to it, so it'll be on mine for sure. All right, everybody. Thank you very much for checking us out at A Funny Way of Looking. We just started a brand new newsletter. You can find it at afunnywayoflooking.news. Check that out. And we're going to have Robert up there. Be sure to check out his websites, his Instagramming, and all that kind of stuff. And we will see you guys in the future. Thank you very much for being here, Robert. And thank you, everybody else, for watching.
Thank you.
We out.